So, Retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day a much-loved entertainer died on live TV.
Then on Tuesday, we remember the Roots sensation of 1977.
On Wednesday, we unearth the bizarre story of the longest war you've never heard of.
On Thursday, the day an Italian became Queen of Poland.
And on Friday, we celebrate... the women who infiltrated the men-only Boston Marathon.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, Man fans. This is the monthly magazine show, The Modern Man. I am its host, Ollie Mann. And here is what we have coming up for you today.
I felt sick and overwhelmed and delighted and a million things all at once reading that sentence.
From handwritten letters to DNA testing, one listener's quest to find her biological parents. Plus,
so once you're done with doing them, you can just compost them.
Alex Fox on sex toy recycling, and Ollie Peart is a dark tourist. It's all to come in this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, or as is the case this month, your doctoral theses. Because Man Fan Caitlin in Sydney, no doubt soon to be Dr. Man Fan Caitlin of the School of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Sydney, has sent me a pre-publication sneak preview of her doctoral thesis, A Glass Half Empty: Assessing the Impact of Empty Flowers on Foraging Behaviour in 3 Bee Species. I know, summer holiday reading sorted. Caitlin has done this for two reasons. One is, you might recall that she got in touch last year regarding bee ejaculate. She had some points of order after Ollie Peart went beekeeping on the show. And so this is an update on her progress. And the other reason, which is terribly exciting, is she has given me, Ollie Mann, a shout out in her thesis. Sadly, a species of bee has not yet been named after me, but I will be following your career with interest, Caitlin. But I am mentioned in the acknowledgements section. Fortunately, this fell on page 10 of 280, so I did make it there. Page 1 was just an illustration. She says, in the acknowledgements, before she thanks her parents, everybody, quote, I definitely couldn't have completed my thesis without a few people I have never met. The voices of Keith Urban, Ollie Mann, and then a couple of other people. So I have been put into a list of Keith Urban. That's my takeaway from this. That's never happened before, to my knowledge. And thanked for being in someone's ears whilst they do something as awesome as research into bee foraging. That is just so much better than an Apple Podcast review. I'm sorry, but it is. Although, you know, if you're not doing a thesis about bee foraging right now and you can't thank me in your PhD acknowledgements, that's okay. An Apple Podcast review will suffice. It does help other people find the show. If you're interested, by the way, in how we make this podcast, some people aren't interested. They don't want to know how the sausage is made. But if you are interested, then we did a webinar. Isn't that a terrible word? For our hosting platform, Audi. Well, I did anyway, and producer Matt and Alex Fox, Ollie was actually in the Falklands at the time, which was modestly entitled How to Have a Hit Podcast. So it's all three of us in discussion talking about how we came up with the format, how we built our audience, how we clear our music, all that kind of stuff. So if you are genuinely interested in podcasting, perhaps want to start a podcast of your own, it's a decent way to spend an hour. It's free. You can fast forward the boring bits. It's on YouTube now, so I've linked to it on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. And thanks very much to everyone who came along and watched it live on the evening as well last month. Right, just before we get going, huge thanks to our sponsors this month, beer52.com. They are my go-to alcohol soundtrack for summer barbecues. I doubt they'd pair well with researching bee ejaculate under lab conditions, but if you're just looking for some superb booze this season, they are on point. The biggest beer club in the world, each month sending their members a case of beer from a different part of the world, and they're offering you a free case just for listening to this show. Head over to beer52.com/modern, cover the meagre postage cost of $5.95, and they will throw in 2 extra beers for free. They're good like that. That is 10 unique craft beers. Now, I like the stouts that taste of ice cream, but a lot of my trousers don't fit. If dark beer is not your thing, then you can choose the light only case. You also get a copy of Ferment magazine and a couple of tasty snacks. And if you're not satisfied for some weird reason, you can simply pause or cancel anytime. That is beer52.com/modern to claim your free case of beer now. beer52.com/modern. And thanks again to them. Right, on today's show, you will learn how the messaging function on MySpace was very useful, actually, for one of our listeners. You will learn how many visitors Auschwitz gets in a typical year, and you'll learn about the Mermaid Parade. Magazine show, everybody. Magazine show. Let's go. Time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested with Manscaped. And Ollie Peart is here. Hello, Ollie.
Hey, Ollie. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I mean, we say here. Of course, we're not in the same room, but you are in the same country as me because you are back from the Falklands.
I'm a bit disorientated. I'm still sort of... I'm getting myself rebalanced to being in the Northern Hemisphere.
So Ollie went to the Falklands for us in part to explore the trend for war tourism because it's the 40th anniversary of the Falklands conflict this year. And I was curious whether others would be following in your path. What's the realities of getting to the Falklands from the UK, Ollie Pitt?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard work, Ollie.
Yeah.
So the way that it works is the flight between the UK and the Falkland Islands is operated by the military, right? So they have a big plane. It's like a normal plane. You know, you get on it. It's got air stewardesses and all that kind of stuff. But there's only 30 seats for civilians. And the other 100 and so are for military contractors and military personnel.
So people take it a bit more seriously when they say don't smoke on board.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's 100 guys with guns back there.
Exactly that. And it also means that you fly out and into military bases. So you have to, you know, like if you're going on a normal flight, you turn up at the airport like 3 hours before. We had to be there like 5 hours before the flight went.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess they're worried about terrorism, are they?
I have no idea. I think it's because they need to get all the military guys kind of sorted out and they just kind of want all the civilians there just so it's not delayed. So you turn up and you just go at the gate of Bryce Norton and there's this crappy little porter cabin with a seat in it and an old jigsaw puzzle with about 15 pieces missing.
What? No duty free? Sushi bar?
There is duty free, weirdly, but it's all like it's operated by the NAFI, which is like a military sort of, well, I don't know, tuck shop, basically. So you can get like your fags and your whiskey and that kind of stuff, but you're not allowed to drink on the flight. It's a dry flight, so you can't drink. You can't even take your own drink. So that bit was a bit rubbish. And then when you land in the military base in the Falklands as well, 18 hours later, it's a freezing cold warehouse about the size of my shed.
But this is adventure tourism, though, Ollie. You're not going to the Falklands for nice lighting and trolleys, are you?
No,
you're going
true.
To have an experience.
Actually, what it really felt like is that you took off from the UK, flew around for 18 hours, and then landed back in the UK, because military bases are the same anywhere in the world.
Yes.
They're all kind of basically the same. So actually, you didn't really feel like you travelled all that far. But then when we got there, it was it had been snowing, and the road between the military base and Stanley, which is the main city in the Falklands,
yes.
It's pretty treacherous at the best of times. I mean, it is really bad. And that night when we were driving back, we were in the back of this rubbish little minivan sliding about. I think something like 8 or 9 cars came off the road.
Who else amongst the civilians on the flight were there for tourism?
None whatsoever. You know, like that, it's a flight that is predominantly for Falkland Islanders. You know, it's called an air bridge. The whole point of it is that it connects the Falkland Islands with the UK. It is their only international flight at the moment, so they don't have any other way of getting in and out.
So hold on, if you're a Falkland Islander then, who has a sister in Sydney,
yeah,
you have to fly via Bryce Norton, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. That's your only way.
Wow.
That is changing, I think, like next month you can get a flight to Chile.
But it's interesting that it doesn't go in the other direction, isn't it? I mean, obviously the Falklanders want the opportunity to leave and arrive at their own island, but it's interesting there aren't British tourists going, because war tourism is a trend, isn't it? I mean, well, that's what we've tasked you with investigating. Is it a trend?
Yeah, it is. You know, and again, like the caveat here, just really boring, but it's, you know, pre-COVID. Yeah, absolutely. So Auschwitz, for example, 2.3 million people visit Auschwitz on a typical year. And I think the difference between Auschwitz and the Falklands is, as I've sort of pointed out, the Falklands is just really difficult and expensive to get to. It's like £2,500 for a flight, for a return flight, to get to the Falkland Islands. That's not the same the other way, by the way. If you're a resident of the Falklands, it's much, much cheaper. So that's the reason people don't go there. You know, you can find yourself on a tour of Europe, and this is one of the things about war tourism, or dark tourism, as actually it's more appropriately called, which covers all kinds of stuff like, you know, war, but also natural disasters and that kind of things. So sort of places that are associated with those, is that tourists don't necessarily travel there explicitly to see those places. But they'll have it as part of an additional itinerary. So they'll go to sort of those parts of Europe and be like, do you know what? I'm going to go and look at this and sort of have that experience.
I've been in that situation where I haven't intended to do some dark tourism, but I have found myself doing it because you're in a place where, you know, that's the most significant thing that's happened there is this thing. So, like, for example, I went to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, because I was interested in that subject. I didn't realise that the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee is so located because that's where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. It's not like I went to go and see the spot where Martin Luther King was killed, but that is where it is. So, I mean, sometimes you can almost sort of stumble into it by accident, can't you, just by going to the thing that is the biggest, you know, tourist spot in the place you happen to be.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people that do travel don't necessarily, you know, think that that's going to form part of their itinerary or even consider themselves to be a dark tourist either. But it'll end up falling into their itinerary just because they're in that place. Like in Amsterdam, they might go to Anne Frank's house because, you know, it's something that people do. You know, that, again, gets millions of visitors each year. But you're going somewhere that was the scene and the site of a real horrible, horrific experience, human experience. That happened to me. The same happened to me when I went to Cambodia. You know, I went to Cambodia.
You got shot in an attic. Surely not.
No. I was locked in a toilet on a bus. Is that the same? It's not quite the same, is it? No, but when I was in Cambodia, it was, you know, we went there for, you know, a nice holiday and to travel. But while we were there, we heard about the Killing Fields, which is a place of mass genocide where hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And we thought at the time, well, maybe it's important that we should go and see this. And I've had to sort of like reflect back on this and just sort of think about what our motivations were. And for me, it was to learn, actually. I was intrigued about why and how somebody could do this to another person. I was not prepared for what I was shown and what was described to me. You know, I knew people had been killed here, but I thought I was just going to kind of walk around and kind of, I don't know, a little bit like walking around a graveyard in a church, just see.
Yeah, like a war memorial. I mean, that's what a war memorial is, isn't it? It's not always in the place where it happened. It's just a bit of stone with some names on you. Like, oh, that's a shame. Let's get an ice cream.
Exactly.
It's different, isn't it, going to the place?
Yeah, it's really different. And there, it's really visceral.
But also, it's that thing I've found as well of we sort of want to believe that places where terrible things happened continue to have a bad vibe. And yet, you know, the truth is, if people don't remember it across hundreds of years later, people forget. And then you don't know. You're in a place and you don't pick up a vibe. You don't know what happened there. You don't know how many people died. Mm. I mean, there must be examples of that with indigenous peoples all across America and Australia, right? Where, you know, white people walking around have no idea what they're looking at. And I kind of think, like, sometimes it's the mundanity of the place. Until you're told what happened there, it doesn't have any sense or resonance in a way.
That was more prominent in the Falklands, actually, because the landscape of the Falklands is not dissimilar to the Lake District. It's not as high, but it's like, you know, it's this sort of beautiful sweeping moors, essentially, is what it looks like, with some rocky terrain and stuff. And we got taken on a war tour with a chap called Tony, who, you know, lived through the war. He was in the Falklands during the war, and he kind of took to doing these war tours, but he also does nature tours. I established quite quickly that nobody in the Falklands has one job. They've got multiple jobs. They do multiple things.
If your only clients are coming in on a weekly flight from Bryce Norton, you've got to diversify, haven't you? Everyone's done the war tour once.
Well, they did used to have, again, they used to have these cruise ships come in from America relatively often. So they used to get a lot of people coming in that way, and there'd be some interest there from people. But a lot of people, myself included, just, you don't know what you're looking at and you don't really know the significance of it. But it takes someone like Tony to talk you through it and say, right, this is a really massive crater. This is how many people died here. This is what happened, whilst you're looking at that landscape. And you start to paint a picture and get a much clearer understanding of quite how horrific and horrible it was. And I think, you know, we all know about the Falklands, but actually trying to fully understand and appreciate what the population went through is really, really difficult. And I don't think you can do that unless you actually go there and see it and hear it firsthand from someone that's kind of experienced that.
Well, also, I think for people of our generation, so both of us were born in the 1980s, i.e. at the same time or just after the Falklands conflict. So when we heard about it, I feel, I don't want to speak for an entire generation of people, but I feel like I was just like, because it didn't come loaded. It didn't come with the whole business of like, the Argentinians are starting a war with us. We need to protect our sovereign territory. The people of the Falklands self-identify as British. I didn't know any of that. The first time I heard about it, I was like, what? Britain went to war for that island, but it's obviously near Argentina. Why are we fighting for that? You know what I mean? Like, so my instinct was not exactly taking up sides with the Argentinians, but I had to justify to myself why Britain went to that war by researching into it. It wasn't my instinctive feeling. But I guess it's very, very different when you're in that place and you're meeting the people that were affected by it.
There's a hall in a place called Goose Green, which is where civilians were basically locked in there for I think it was 30 days or something. You know, it was horrible in there, really disgusting with families and stuff like that. And then you start talking to some of the locals, even the younger locals, and they'll be like, yeah, my gran was in that hall or my mum was in that hall. And they still have that connection with it. And actually, it's recent history. You know, it's only 40 years ago. And for the people of the Falkland Islands, their relationship now with Argentina is still really awful. And as far as they're concerned, that war has not ended. It has not finished. So you're seeing these places and you're going to visit and you're asking these questions and these people are talking to you about it. And you're reminded that actually this hasn't gone away. And it's the same for all, a lot of other dark tourism sites. So sort of the ethics of going to visit too soon can be problematic. Yeah. The killing fields, actually, a lot of people do question whether or not the way that you visit it, the way that you kind of are taken around it, is that right? Because a lot of Cambodians, because it's still relatively recent and fresh in their memory, still have a really strong connection with that.
History is written by the victor. So, you know, that's always going to be the case, isn't it? Whoever's showing you around the land are the people that are on the land now.
But there is, I mean, there are people that do go purely for some slightly grotesque reasons. After Hurricane Katrina, there was an influx of people that headed to New Orleans to just go and basically snap photos of the destruction because they were sort of intrigued by it.
Yeah, I suppose the difference there as well, you think about places like Ireland or Israel, is that there are countries where there are either contemporaneous or recent conflicts going on, but the people that are going there as tourists probably have some link anyway. You know, so you'll get British and European Jews going to Israel. You'll get American Irish immigrants going to Ireland to see where their ancestors are from. So in a way, if they're told a slightly biased version of what they're looking at, they can either put it in context or they're going to be feeling some sympathy with that view anyway. But going to a place to which you have no connection immediately after a thing has just happened, I guess it can just seem ghoulish.
And the vast majority of people that do go to the Falklands are people that do have a connection with it. So there'll be ex-military servicemen, for example, that will go to Tony and they will say, look, I remember this specific place. And it might just be the shape of a rock, which they remember. And Tony will go and take them to go and see it. And it will be the site of where maybe they killed an Argentinian or they were shot at or very nearly lost their life. And it's for them to help them kind of process that experience and what that was like. So I can understand people doing that and even families that are connected with it to try and get a better understanding of exactly what happened. But yeah, you're right. I think if you don't have that connection, it can seem ghoulish. And that's where the sort of the time sensitivity thing comes in, like Pompeii. I think going to visit Pompeii right. And kind of look at it is probably all right. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's the same thing of like imagining yourself as a civilian. That's the thing, isn't it? Like, I think of the Falklands and I think of the Brits who went to the Falklands were mostly serving in the army and had chosen to do so. For the people that are there, like you say, my nan got locked in this cellar for 30 days. It's a completely different experience, isn't it? And what you're doing by walking around is you're identifying with the civilian experience of having this thing thrust upon you. And I guess that is what you're doing in Pompeii. It is just, tragedy plus time.
That was something that was just felt very different when I was in Cambodia, because you the minute I went back to our tuk-tuk to the driver that dropped us off, I had a completely different feeling about him. And I think I actually apologised to him. I think I said, I'm really sorry. You know, I'm really sorry that you went through that.
So in conclusion then, Ollie, do you think this trend for dark tourism can be a good thing?
Well, I actually asked that question to Tony, who took us around the sites in the Falklands, and I said, you know, I asked him if he thought it was appropriate that we were visiting these sites and if it was okay. And his answer was absolutely, because we have to learn from the past. You know, we have to learn from those experiences so that we don't go through them again, which is a optimistic view, because I feel like we're kind of going through it all again now at the moment.
Yeah, but so many things.
Yeah.
And that particular experience isn't going to actually affect you, is it? You don't live on an island next to Argentina.
But this is the thing, you know, maybe if more people did see these places after those experiences, then we wouldn't be going through them as much as we are again. And I think it is important. I think it's really important that we do see these places, but just in a respectful way.
Okay, I'm glad I don't have to segue immediately into pubic trimmers, because first we're going to find out what your trend is for next month. Would you like to know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
It's something very different. It's from Paul in Folkestone, who says...
Hi, Paul.
I've never had so many weddings to attend as I have this year. That's the COVID backlog, Ollie. Are you not a fan of weddings? Of course you're not. You've postponed your own by about 10 years.
I am a fan. I'm a fan of other people's weddings. It's kind of fine. I do feel sorry for him, because when you get them back to back, it's a bit like, oh, come on.
Yeah, you're wrong. I love weddings. But anyway, he says, that means sitting through a lot of speeches, and a lot of them aren't very good. And that made me think, could I challenge Ollie to create the ultimate best man speech?
Well, yeah, of course he can. And I'm glad he has. I know exactly what he's talking about, by the way, sitting through shitty speeches.
What do people get wrong, in your view?
Right. So they're too long, for a start.
Like, yes, brevity is important.
Oh my God. Just no one cares. Shut up. We just want the free food and drink. Yeah, okay, say your bit and then sod off. We're not interested. Yeah, congratulations.
No, there's a template, Ollie. This is what I want you to explore. And whilst you're there on that internet, why not get yourself an excellent pubic trimmer from the good people at manscaped.com, sponsors of The Zeitgeist?
Yeah, you could grab their grooming package, the Performance Package 4.0, Ollie. Great for trimming your bush.
Is bush, because there's this whole campaign with Manscaped at the moment, which has got bush. Do you think of a male pubic region as a bush? That seems to me like slang for a female pubic, which of course women can use Manscaped products too, and they're excellent on all pubic hair. But do you ever refer to your bush as bush?
No, I don't. And it's a great observation, because actually I think males generally don't have a word for their pubic hairy bits. Just pubes, actually. It's just pubes, which is gross. Yeah. You know, I quite like bush or muff or anything like that. It's quite nice, but... pubes, just, I don't know, it's quite disgusting.
Well, I suppose, why have a word for something that no longer exists? Because after you've used the lawnmower 4.0, it's all gone. There is no trace of it left if you should choose to be as smooth as a baby.
Yeah, and the second best tool in the performance package is the Weed Whacker. This is a nose and ear hair trimmer, which is absolutely brilliant. I have to be quite careful because I have a moustache, and if my nose hairs get too long, then they get entangled with my tash.
Yeah, so
I have
to make sure separate, can't you? Church and state.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You can also buy yourself some Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant and the Crop Reviver Spray-On Testy Toner from manscaped.com, and you can get 20% off plus free shipping when you use our code MAN.
That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com, and use our code MANN.
It's time you level up from the Amazon to the Amadong with the ultimate bushwhacking tools from Manscaped. See you next month, Ollie.
Yeah, see you next month. Bye.
In a moment, you'll meet our guest, Vicky, but first it's time for our record of the month. It's by Max Pope. It is, as you can hear, rather summery, laid-back vibes, hollybobs. It's called Better Late Than Never. Enjoy.
I feel the weight of the world, the sun. A heavy load to bear, and I can hardly breathe, but I know there's time to start again, and I'll always be in debt. Another way of the world is pain.
Now, we here at The Modern Man love nothing more than being your platform to tell your stories, things that have happened in your life that merit being told to a wider audience. Other podcasts do celebrities, other podcasts interview everybody who's got a book out. What we are genuinely most interested in is when we can bring you a story you don't hear anywhere else. Our contact details, if you'd like to share your story on the show, or if indeed you're about to give a best man speech and you're willing for Ollie Peart to co-write it with you, are on our website, modernmanwith2ns.co.uk, then click the feedback form. We don't always have time to respond to every email, as I've said before, but we do read all your letters, and some of my favourite episodes have come about just by us following up on your contributions. And this month, it's the turn of man fan Vicky Sanderton, who now lives in Australia but grew up in the UK with adoptive parents. I started by asking her what she thought her experiences might tell us about adoption and what she thought might be missing from the general conversation about adoption.
I think it's pitched a lot of the time as this sort of fairy tale where absolutely well-meaning adoptive parents who just want to love a child kind of swoop in and rescue a child that needs rescuing. But I think it's important to understand, you know, and I see that this from all the Facebook support groups I'm in, that it can often lead to quite a complicated adulthood, even when it's gone well. So, you know, in terms of identity issues and knowing your background and knowing where you come from. This is why it's quite frustrating to keep hearing, you know, people defending the overturning of Roe versus Wade, where they think that adoption is just an easy solution. And I would say there's an awful lot more to it than people think. There's a term that they use, which is coming out of the fog. As an adoptee, you grow up feeling that you should feel lucky and grateful all the time because people took you in that didn't have to take you in. And on the flip side of that, you're made to feel incredibly special. It was like, you know, we so wanted a baby and we couldn't have one of our own, so we chose you. And that, to be honest, fucks you up. You start to feel like you were the answer to this huge problem and you are therefore responsible for people's happiness.
But also you were a huge problem for somebody else.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So it can lead to a very, very confusing sense of who you are and what is expected of you.
Vicky spent her childhood in Gillingham in Kent, her mother Sheila, her father Chris.
So Chris was a long distance truck driver, so he actually wasn't around a lot. It was mostly me and Mum. So we were very, very close. I remember that Mum would always really look forward to my school holidays. She genuinely loved the two of us being able to spend a lot of time together. And she worked in a school canteen, so we had the same holidays, which was really convenient. I had a lot of happy times with me and my mum, not so many with Chris around. And they actually went on to separate when I was 8.
Was that difficult for you?
No, I was really relieved. I picked up on the tensions between the two of them very vividly. And I remember the day that Mum sat me down and said, "Your dad's going to move out." And my 8-year-old brain went, "Oh, thank God for that. Thank God for that. It's easier when he's not here."
Yeah. I mean, as a dad, that's not the thing you want to hear, is it? What do you think he thought of his relationship with you?
I think with, you know, hindsight and maturity, I think he didn't want to be a parent. I think that having a baby was really important to my mum, and they tried, and, you know, medical things meant that they couldn't conceive naturally. And I don't know if it's different now, but back then the adoption process was quite full on. You know, it took them years to adopt me, and there was a lot of, you know, social workers coming to the house for spot checks to make sure it was an okay place to bring up a baby. And it was quite invasive. It probably still is now. But I get the sense that that process kind of killed their relationship.
All through her childhood, Vicky was told she was adopted. But then, around the age of 8 or 9, Sheila gave Vicky a letter.
She said that the social worker who dealt with my adoption had written this letter and had given it to her and said, "You know, obviously it's up to you if you want to pass this on to Vicky at any stage." Mum had given it a lot of thought and she said, "I think you're grown up enough to have this letter, and I want you to know all there is to know about your first mum, basically. It was a letter that had been typed on a typewriter because, you know, this was the days before people had computers. So it was kind of this higgledy-piggledy letter on, like, stained paper. So I felt a great sense of pride that I was grown up enough to, you know, read this grown-up letter written by a grown-up about other grown-ups.
What did it say?
So it contained a lot of information about my biological mother and, you know, her history, her family. It told me her full name. It told me her date of birth and that she was born close to Dublin in Ireland, that she had grown up in a sort of Catholic family and that her parents had been publicans. So they'd run a pub.
And just that, Vicky, just that so far, what you know already.
Is a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot to, for an 8-year-old, it's a lot to think about.
Yeah, I guess it was. I found it very exciting. I sort of didn't realise at the time that I basically had enough information from that letter to find her.
What else did it tell you?
It told me what she was like. So the social worker had sort of commented on her personality and said she was very warm, and it used the word curious as well. She's very curious and kind, I think. So that was nice to read.
What was her name?
Jacinta. For some reason, I had it in my young mind that she was in London. I think it's because I knew I'd been born in London, so it also told me that that I was born in Lewisham Hospital, which is something I knew because Mum had told me that. But in my mind, she'd given birth to me there and had never left London. So often when I went on school trips to London, I would be glued to the window of the coach looking for a stranger in the crowd who looked like me because I thought I might just spot her one day.
See, that sounds like a child who is looking for something. And you were saying that you were happy and you were unaffected by it. But kids who are completely satisfied with their adoptive family don't look out the window looking for strangers to see if it's their mum.
I think what I wanted was to see someone I looked like. You grow up and you see your friends looking like their parents, and it's commented on quite a lot with other children. And, well, even for me, it was commented on quite a lot, which was bizarre because strangers would say, oh, aren't you like your mum? And that was a weird thing to handle because it's like, well, no, I mean, we've both got brown hair, but no. And looking back, I don't know if that was, it's just what people say, even if it's not true. Or so it was quite a big thing when I was growing up. I noticed it. I guess I was around 14 or 15 when I really started to think about the future and if it was important to me to meet Jacinta. And around this time as well, I cut off contact with my adoptive dad because he was just behaving appallingly and I wanted nothing to do with him. So I guess that might have led me to sort of think a bit more deeply about parents and what they mean and what I expected from them. By that stage, my mum had remarried my wonderful, wonderful stepdad, who we call Daddy John. And I think he was there as a shining example of what a dad should be. And yeah, that also really helped. So I guess I had a few mirrors to look into about what a parent should be.
So this is 2006, when the internet's kind of a big deal. Right before this point, you had a typed out letter. But now you've got the temptation, presumably, to Google Jacinta.
Yes. So it started back at uni when I had access to a computer all of a sudden, and Friends Reunited was a thing. And I did find her on Friends Reunited, but there wasn't a picture of her. I don't even remember if we had profile pictures on Friends Reunited.
We've done a deep dive on Friends Reunited. You had to pay £5 to have your photo. So
right.
That's what she hadn't done. She hadn't sent the check in the post to one of our former guests.
There we go. That was a great episode. Yes. Okay. So neither of us had shelled out a fiver. So she had no profile picture, and her bio was very, very brief.
But you knew she was alive. I mean, I guess that's still a baseline, isn't it?
Yes. Seeing her name on screen and knowing that she had typed out that name and that was her was weird, really weird. And I don't want to say exciting, because at the time it felt more like reassurance than excitement, because I had no intention of this being the start of a search for her. So it was just, oh yeah, she's there, she is. I decided that I definitely wanted to find her one day, purely out of curiosity, really kind of narcissistic curiosity, because I wanted to understand why I am the way I am. And I thought that finding where I'd come from might offer some answers. But I'd also made a promise to myself that I would do it when I was at a stage in my life where I felt settled, because I was very conscious that if I'd started a search for her and it had taken months or years and then found her and she'd rejected me and said, I don't want anything to do with you, that it could have torn me to pieces, you know, mentally and emotionally. So yeah, I always thought, let's wait till things are kind of settled and I could take the rejection if that were to be the outcome.
Still to come, what happened when Vicky was ready to make contact with her birth mother? That's when The Modern Man returns, after this. Man fans, summer is here. It's official. And whatever you've got planned, whether it's on the beach, a city break, work or play, Stitch Fix is here to make sure that your wardrobe is perfect for all occasions. They send someone, an actual human, out to shop for you. Someone who knows your size, what you do and don't like to wear, and how much you like to spend on each item. Stitch Fix, quite simply, take the pain out of shopping for clothes. The outfits then arrive at your door a few days later. You get to try everything on at home, decide what to keep, and then send anything else back. It's so easy. You pay just £10 each time you order, which is credited towards the items you keep, and you'll get 20% off when you keep all 5 items. There's no subscription required, plus shipping, returns, and exchanges are easy and free. To get started, go to stitchfix.co.uk/man to set up your profile, and then they'll deliver clothes chosen just for you in your taste, size, and budget. That's stitchfix.co.uk/man, M-A-W. N for 20% off when you keep all 5 items in your fix. Man fans, let's talk about skin. You probably already moisturise. It's the 21st century, after all. But do you scrub? Do you exfoliate? Do you cleanse, hydrate and protect? Have you ever thought about actually doing something about those circles under your eyes? If you're the kind of guy who wants to look your best, but perhaps would feel embarrassed talking about this stuff in a department store, or you don't have the time to start searching for products online, well, Tiege Hanley make it easy. They'll send you a selection of their excellent lotions and potions that really do feel great on your face. Trust me, I've tried it. And because Tiege Hanley is sponsoring today's episode, they're offering you a great deal. Just go to tiege.com/man and you'll get 30% off your first box, plus a free gift. That's tiege.com/man. That's an amazing deal. Back to Vicky's story now, and we join her in the noughties. She's now graduated from university, she's got herself a job at Hasbro, and in the evenings, she keeps finding herself searching for her birth mother, Jacinta, online.
I would have a glass of wine open up my laptop and Google her. And I never found anything.
Nothing.
There were references to her being a big part of the Buddhist community in the UK.
That's not what you expect from a Catholic Irish publican, is it?
Exactly. So on one of these random, let's Google her occasions, I did look up resources for adoptees, and I found a kind of online message board where people who had been adopted could just leave a message for someone they were trying to reach out to. And I thought, sod it, why not? I'm here. So I wrote a message on this board saying I'd love to get in contact with Jacinta, who was born on this date in Ireland. I believe she's my biological mother, and, you know, Jacinta, if you're reading this, I don't want anything from you. I'm just curious, and I would like to get to know you. And I left it at that. I got an email a few days later from, it was one of the moderators of the message board who very kindly had searched through some birth, deaths and marriage records for me, which is something that, again, because I sort of accidentally started my search without giving it too much thought, that hadn't even occurred to me. The nugget of information that their search gave me that was completely new to me was that I had a sister, Siobhan.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I knew I had a younger sister for the first time ever.
And I presume then there's a father's name as well, although I presume also that you're presuming that's not your father because it was so many years later.
Exactly. Yes.
There's still a lot to think about.
Yes. There's a lot to think about, yeah. I think my main concern was whether or not this sister of mine, who I assumed was a half-sister, although obviously could have been a full biological sister, because I knew nothing about my dad, my biological dad. I just wondered whether she knew that I existed. That was a biggie for me.
Yeah, because on some level, your mum was probably always thinking you might get in touch. Her other daughter might not know you exist at all.
Yeah. It took me a while to stalk her. It sounds like I was very lazy with this whole process. I was very casual about the whole thing.
No, it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like you're not quite sure what to do, and you know that there are unanswered questions, and you don't want to hurt yourself.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. And I think one of my biggest concerns had always been, well, obviously Jacinta knows that I exist, but what if she has this family around her who have no idea that I exist, and I didn't want to go in there all guns blazing, introducing myself and tear a family apart, essentially, if they didn't know that I existed. So I thought to myself, she's 17, she's in the UK. I knew that she was born in Reading in the UK, so I assumed that's where she would still be, or somewhere around there. So I searched for her on MySpace and found someone I was pretty confident was her immediately. So
then you're looking at an image.
Then I could see a face for the first time, which was odd. So I started, and this is going to sound really creepy, but on her MySpace, she had a live journal.
Wow, this is a real history of blogging and social media from a long time ago. Live journal, kids.
We're going to get into GeoCities next.
Yeah, exactly. So it's it was a very pure blog, right? Like a chronological diary.
Yes, exactly. Like an online diary.
And that was pinned right there, and you could go straight into her head.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I wasn't a connection of hers on MySpace. I was just, I could have been anyone in the world reading her diary, yes. I got into the habit of reading it every day for about 2 weeks, and mostly it was quite kind of surface level stuff, and here's what's going on at school, I'm going to stay at my dad's this weekend. So I got from that that, you know, her parents weren't together anymore. I think I continued to read it because I wanted a clue that it was definitely her, you know, she was definitely my sister.
Yeah.
And I got that. One day I got home from work. It was a Friday afternoon. Sat down at my laptop, opened up the live journal. It was the start of school holidays for her. So she wrote a bit about school holidays, here are my plans. And then I can remember the exact wording. She went on to write, "And in other news, those of you who know me well know that I have an older sister who was given up for adoption as a baby."
Wow.
And I nearly threw up. It was the ultimate headfuck.
Yes.
I burst into tears.
What did you think it meant?
I knew I wasn't a secret. The fact that she used the word sister meant a lot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I wasn't just that baby that her mum had given up for adoption. I was her sister. I felt sick and overwhelmed and delighted and a million things all at once reading that sentence.
And I suppose in a way it kind of validated this approach of constantly checking in, because again, it seems strange, it's such recent history, but people forget now in this age of push notifications, you did have to go home, open your laptop, log onto the website, click the link, refresh. It was active all the time. Like, you weren't waiting for this information to come to you, you were seeking it out. And it could have been the opposite of this feeling, couldn't it? You could have found something that really made you think, oh god, why did I ever start looking into this?
Yeah. And, you know, it's not something I could do on my phone on the train to work back then. And
yeah.
I think even MySpace was blocked at work. So it was a very deliberate, you know, I'm going to go home and look at MySpace today. Seeing that she knew who I was or knew that I existed meant everything. She went on to write that her mum had received an email from, I think, as she phrased it, some dude from the BBC who was making a documentary about reuniting adoptees with their biological parents. And what essentially had happened is that this producer had found the message board that I'd left a message on and reached out to Jacinta to say, your daughter's looking for you. I can help with the reunion if you'd like to be a part of our documentary. She'd written in that day's journal entry, I've always known I had a sister who was adopted as a baby. We are so excited that she is trying to find us. I've been waiting for this day my whole life.
So this isn't just a post that you've stumbled upon, is it?
No.
This is a post that's sort of designed for you to read.
Yeah.
Had you told your mum that you were about to reach out?
She didn't know any of this was happening. Not because I was deliberately keeping it from her, but because, you know, I didn't want to involve her until I knew I was absolutely going to reach out. You know, I really wanted to make sure that she felt comfortable and it wasn't going to jeopardise our relationship. So, you know, I said, I'm not doing this because I'm looking for my, you know, quote, real mum. You're my real mum. You're the person that has raised me. I'm just really curious. And I feel like I've been a jigsaw puzzle with one piece missing, and I just want to put that piece in place. And she was very honest with me. She said that she felt pretty weird about the whole thing, but she totally understood and would do exactly the same in my position. So I had her blessing to reach out, which was important to me. So I actually reached out from her house that very afternoon.
How?
Via MySpace. I found Siobhan's profile and opened up the little message function and said, "Hi, Siobhan. This might sound weird, but I think I'm your sister."
Such an inappropriate forum for such a heavy conversation, isn't it?
I know.
Yes. I suppose at least it wasn't Twitter.
Yeah. This is true. Yeah, I said, "I think I'm your sister. I read your journal and what you wrote tallies up with what's been happening with me recently. I would love to be in touch with you and your mum." I was very conscious of establishing the boundaries that, you know, I wasn't thinking of Jacinta as our mum, very much Siobhan's mum. And yeah, I hope to hear back from you. Send. She literally replied minutes after I'd sent the message to the effect of, you know, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, you know, I'm so excited. I can't believe this is happening. Thank you for reaching out. I've let my mum know. How do you want to be in touch? Do you want to email? What do you want to do?" I said it would be really nice to initially email Jacinta. I really, really didn't want a phone call. And looking back, it was weird reasoning, but I had this thing where I didn't want to hear her voice until she was standing in front of me in person. And I don't know why that was. One thing I do remember from her initial email was she asked if I'd had a happy childhood. And I said, yes. You know, I felt very loved. And she replied saying that that had been the most important thing to her. So she was very, very happy to hear that.
I mean, they're such small words, aren't they? But they mean a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
"Have you had a happy childhood?" I mean, I can just imagine that that's what she'd been thinking about for...
Yeah.
26 years, really.
Yeah.
And possibly would never know the answer to. That's what's been playing on her mind, right?
Yes. Yeah. We decided that, because I was living in Acton... at the time, North Acton, and she was living in Reading, it turned out that Richmond was a good place for us to both get to on the train. So what we hadn't factored in, naively, was that meeting on the steps at Richmond Station is all well and good, unless it's a rugby day. I was swamped by excited rugby fans heading to the pub.
Okay, so you weren't trying to pick through the crowd. You weren't like, "Which of these is my mother?"
I was just trying not to get knocked off my feet at that stage. 2 minutes before I knew her train was arriving, a guy I worked with came out of the train station, and it was someone that I worked with kind of, but didn't know
to have a chit chat.
And I actually just thought, you know, I can't be making small talk with Erin when I meet my birth mother for the first time. So I basically said to him, "This is going to be really rude. You have to go. I can't talk to you now. I'll explain at work on Monday." And he was like, oh, are you okay? I was like, "I'm fine, but you have to go." So we saw each other. She walked towards me. We had a very, very tight and long hug. She cried a lot. I didn't cry. I couldn't speak. I was just gobsmacked. even now it feels very emotional to talk about. It was like looking in a mirror for the first time. I said, should we just walk? Should we walk and find somewhere? And she said yes, and we sort of like walked through Richmond, kind of clutching each other and shaking. We approached this Italian restaurant and I said, do you like Italian? And she went, yes. And I said, shall we go in here? And she said, yes. So we sat opposite each other at this, you know, small Italian restaurant, and we were there for 8 hours. The staff got to know our story quite quickly. They bought us a plant each to commemorate the day. And it took us a very, very long time to order any food because obviously we had a lot to talk about. At one point I said to her, look, should we just get some food ordered? Because we'd already, like, we'd started drinking wine. Turns out we both absolute fiends for red wine. So I was like, let's just get some food. This was about an hour after arriving at the restaurant, and we looked at our menus and I said, I don't know why I'm even looking. I always get the same thing at an Italian restaurant. And she said, so do I. And pretty much in unison, you know, Disney film style, we said spaghetti marinara. It was like finding out why I am the way I am. Like, I as a person came together in my own head that day.
It illuminated things that were missing that you couldn't even vocalise before.
Yes. Seeing someone who not only looked like me, but who I shared mannerisms with and a view of the world with.
I don't know much, because I've not been in this position, obviously, about what's advised for people that have been adopted meeting their birth parents for the first time, but I know it's not this. I know that you're not supposed to meet for 8 hours and get pissed. And I think the reason for that is, for some people it would just be too overwhelming, wouldn't it? And they'd start looking for connections that weren't there, even, maybe, because they're so overwhelmed by meeting someone who looks like them. Was there a part of you that was a little bit worried that you've just plunged straight into this?
I'd had a great day, and I mean, the adrenaline was just pumping the whole time I was with her. But I've got to say, the following day, I felt kind of afraid. And yeah, there was definitely a nervousness that, like, with what happens now, you know, how do we, what will we be to each other going forward? Are we friends? Is she my mother? Like, what are we? So yeah, it was exciting and terrifying. It was the second time I met Jacinta that Siobhan was there, and the three of us went for dinner.
Spaghetti marinara?
No, we went for Asian that time. And meeting Siobhan was strange because of that imbalance where she'd always known that I existed. Again, she grew up knowing that there was this big sister out there somewhere. And in her mind, I think that what she'd hoped was weirdly the thing that I had been fearing she wouldn't want, which was me to just slot into life as this big sister. Turns out that's what she wanted from me. And I just didn't feel that because we didn't have that shared history, but she sort of felt that we did because she knew about me the whole time.
And what about the relationship between Sheila and Jacinta?
So they met in person as part of the flurry of everybody meeting everyone in person. I was quite keen for them to meet fairly quickly because Mum felt a little bit understandably sort of jealous when I started spending time with Jacinta. And, you know, it was a very exciting time for me, and it must have been a really weird time for her So, yeah, I think it was about 3 or 4 months into mine and Jacinta's relationship that I got the two mums together for the first time. And that was a really lovely moment. Basically, they just, there was a very big hug and they both thanked each other, which was very sweet to watch. Mum thanked Jacinta for having me and Jacinta thanked Mum for raising me. So that was nice and good, you know, ego boost as well.
Do you have any more intel about who your father was?
Yes. Jacinta has been very open with me about that. So we know that his name was Joe.
And this was on a US Army base in Germany, did you say?
Yeah, in 1981. She found out that he was married and basically, you know, said, I don't want anything to do with a married man. And he said to her that the marriage wasn't working because he really wanted to have children and his wife didn't. And he thought it was going to be the end of them, which is ironic given he now has a almost 40-year-old child he doesn't know exists.
Yeah.
But I have started searching for him.
So it's sort of doing it all again.
A little bit, but this time trying to find someone who doesn't know that I exist.
Do you know the surname of the man she thinks is your father?
No, just know that his first name is Joe and he's American.
Is there a piece of the jigsaw missing again?
The stakes don't feel as high. And to be honest with you, it had really never occurred to me to find him until quite recently. So I had a series of very helpful therapy sessions a few months ago, and it came up during one of those sessions where the therapist said, have you ever thought about finding your father? And I said, no, I haven't. I feel like I got everything I needed from finding Jacinta. But that kind of set off a thought process of, well, I mean, it would be quite nice to know, to have the full picture. And at around the same time, I know I'm in quite a lot of groups for adoptees on Facebook. They're talking about, you know, at-home DNA testing through like 23andMe and Ancestry.
Yes, because that is the thing that's, wow, you know, we really are telling the story of the internet, aren't we?
We really are, yes.
That is the thing that's come along. So it was Friends Reunited, MySpace and LiveJournal, but it is now 23andMe. So you can spit into a bottle and theoretically find out who your father is that way.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought, well, do you know what? It would be fun to see the genetic breakdown of, you know, how Irish I am and how whatever I am. So let's just do it. And if a father appears in the process, then bonus, I guess. I did 23andMe and I've had my results. He's not in that database, that DNA database. What did spring up from those results that I sort of didn't really prepare for was that, you know, it breaks down that, oh, this person's on your biological father's side and you share 2.4% DNA, for example. So with those results came names of people that my biological father is related to. No one closer to me than, say, a third cousin. So we're not talking, you know, siblings or anything.
Yeah, but someone who would be able to say, yeah, this was Joe and he was in Germany in 1980, whatever.
Yeah, just seeing those names has opened up a whole other part of my thinking around this, where it's like, oh, you know, just like when I got that email from that moderator saying Jacinta had another baby and her name is Siobhan. It's kind of like it's putting people, like other people in the story. And therefore, now I sort of do want to know more about my father.
I mean, for all you know, he's still in the same marriage he was then.
Yeah. Or he's dead. You know, that's another thing that I need to prepare for. So
what kind of age is he? Is he just into his age or is he older?
She thinks he's around the same age as her, yeah. So he'd be around 60, mid-60s.
And that is where Vicky's story ends, for the moment. She might find out who her father is. That's partly up to her, and partly, perhaps, up to you. If you think you can help Vicky find Joe, do drop us a line via the feedback form, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. Still to come, your sex questions answered with Alex Fox. After this. This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. It's spring. The sun is finally out. The daffodils are in bloom. I am so grateful at this time of year, even just picking my kids up from school, to be feeling that uplift in my mood. But then people try and talk to me. They'll say, "How are you?" And I'll suddenly think, "I don't know, because I don't speak to anybody. I sit in my office at home by myself, working from home. I'm not used to conversation." And suddenly I feel a bit vulnerable. It might be you're the reverse. It might be that you're constantly going out and meeting people and talking to people, but then feel like you've drained your social battery and you just want more time to yourself. In either case, that can put a bit of a downer on spring. And that is an example of where therapy can help to improve your self-awareness and build yourself a social life that won't drain your battery. And seriously, BetterHelp is the way to give therapy a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. And our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/man. That's betterhelp.com/MANN. Time for the Foxhole, your sex questions answered with Alex Fox in person. Hello, Alex.
Salubrious and lubricated greetings to you, Ollie Man.
What have you been up to?
I recently went to the Coney Island Mermaid Parade. So people dress up as pirates and seahorses and starfish. And it's like a big celebration of not only Coney Island, but people's self-expression and the community there.
I mean, mermaids then. So I imagine a lot of drag queens. That's what I'm guessing.
There's a whole lot of drag on that drag. But also it does get, perhaps unsurprisingly, a little political. This year, there were lots of Roe v. Wade rowing boats, for example. I was also kind of surprised to see this massive float that proclaimed justice for foreskins. I think they phrased it forefins, in line with the sea life theme. I mean, I've actually brought along...
Please tell me you haven't brought a bag of foreskins with you.
No, they were handing out these
Phineas
leaflets.
Phineas and Aquata protect foreskins, it says on this leaflet you've passed me. And then they've sort of... I imagine these are the people who run the float, are they? And they've done themselves up as like comic book heroes. It's a foreskin restoration concept?
They are activists, a movement known as Intaction, which is a play on action and being intact, i.e. not having a bit of your wang cut off. And they stand for what they believe to be the four powers of foreskin, which are providing pleasure, protection, lubrication, and connection between lovers. I'm a little bit more dubious about that one, because I think you still can, you absolutely have the capacity to have connected emotional sex as somebody without a foreskin. They also have a competition where you can vote for your favourite celebrity with foreskin.
How do you find out what celebrities have foreskins, and anyway, who's in the top five?
Well, they list Leonardo DiCaprio. Right. I do not know now how they found out about his foreskin status.
Well, to be fair, there have been plenty of witnesses over the years.
Orlando Bloom, who quite famously did naked paddleboarding, and he practically used his foreskin as a sail.
Yes.
So I think we can safely say that he's got one. And also A.C. Slater from Saved by the Bell.
Right.
Obscurely, he has apparently saved his bell end.
I suppose that's not an award you can campaign for, isn't it? You're either eligible or you're not. It's time for our question of sex, brought to you this month by ExpressVPN.
They provide software that encrypts your data to keep your private searches very much like your private parts, i.e. private.
And it comes from Catherine, who says, "My husband and I recently updated our toy collection.
We're talking sex toys, obviously. And I noticed my favourite rabbit has finally wriggled its ears for the last time. I'd like to ask Alex, therefore, about disposing of or recycling old sex toys once they've given up the ghost. How do I avoid the embarrassment of taking it to somewhere that's not appropriate? I love the idea of turning up to Potter's Bar Recycling Centre. Saying, which bin does this go in, mate?
Or just anywhere. Harvester on a Sunday.
And is there such a thing as recycling them?
Short answer is yes, you can in theory recycle your rabbit after it's had it, but like so many things, it's not as straightforward as it perhaps should be.
Because what it should be, and I would hope it was, is that I guess you have a similar situation to sort of plastic bags at the supermarket. You know, regardless what supermarket you got it from, you can leave them here. You'd think a company like Ann Summers or Love Honey would say, just give us your old sex toys when we're buying a new one.
Well, they used to, actually. Love Honey had this, I think they called it the rabbit amnesty scheme, where you could get, you could send them your old sex toys and they would recycle them for you, but also give you points towards a new toy. They now say that they will take back a toy on a like-for-like basis if you buy a new one. So it's all a little bit more regimented. They don't offer you points anymore. In fact, a lot of toy stores globally who used to advocate for recycling and were quite loud in proclaiming that you could send all your old dildos and dongs their way and they'd make sure that after they'd finished rocking your world they didn't hurt the earth, a lot of them have kind of like quietly gone defunct or at least been scaled back. There was one I could find in Australia that will only take toys weighing 300 grams or less. So if your big donkey dick is ready to go to the glue factory, then you're fucked, unfortunately.
But also, what do you do? I mean, I imagine it's quite hard, even for a company of the scale of Love Honey, to work out how to recycle, you know, 10,000 old rabbits.
The problems that companies are facing are similar to the problems that your average consumer is going to be facing. The first thing is that you need to know what your toy is made out of. If it's something like a real low-grade jelly-style plastic, then unfortunately there is no hope for it in terms of environmental goodness. As an aside, I found some very funny blogs where people had these toys that couldn't be recycled and were desperately trying to dispose of them in discreet ways. There was one guy who was hacking his mega dildo up into like salami-esque slices and sneaking them into the waste paper basket so that he wouldn't get nobbled for having his giant knob.
Yeah, because it's often a purchase that people are not particularly proud of, isn't it? They will have destroyed the packaging, they'd have gone back and thrown away the receipt. They may not even know what this thing is anymore.
If your sex toy is made of something like pure silicone or ABS plastics or wood or metal or glass, in theory those things you should be able to recycle them. But just taking your fully formed Roger Rabbit down to the tip, yeah, there is, unfortunately, there's an element of shame and stigma there. Officially, in the UK, anything that has a charger, a plug, or takes batteries, you should be able to recycle that. So if you hop over to your local council website or look on recyclenow.com, they'll tell you where you can take that. I would really like to hear from anybody who works in the recycling industry about how many do actually get dismantled and all their component parts recycled, because it's an very labour-intensive process. I've also heard from people in the US saying that when they've tried to recycle toys, they've been told that places just won't accept them because they're a biohazard. So, yes, you should be able to recycle these. They depend on you having access to a robust system that does actually do what it promises. So an alternative, rather than take them to the tip, is to see if somebody else would like to use them.
I was really hoping you weren't going to say that. Well, I just think, I mean, it just doesn't seem like a product where you should be saying, it's the Airbnb of, you know, which is what people do in Silicon Valley. Is there a need for a secondhand sex toy apart from amongst fetishists? I can't help wondering.
There is.
Take the fetishists out of it, Alex. Be honest.
There's a massive subreddit, r/usedsextoys, where, yes, there's a contingent of people who are turned on by the fact that somebody else has used the toy.
Put those to one side. Who is left?
There are a lot of people who
I'd rather crowdfund for that person who desperately needs a vibrator. Do you know what I mean?
They want a bargain. They're after a bargain. And provided your toy is still working and it's non-porous so it can be cleaned thoroughly, you might be able to get a few bob for something once you've finished doing your thing on your knob.
Where, though? Because I imagine that's against the eBay terms and conditions, isn't it? And Facebook as well doesn't like anything sexually explicit. Where do you list it?
People do still try and sneak listings onto both of those platforms, usually using descriptions that neatly get around all of the words that are going to sound alarm bells. This is a subreddit, so if you're there, you want to look.
Mm.
You're in the market for buying a used sex toy.
So you can post it there, can you? Post a picture there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And put your PayPal details.
Yeah. And sell on.
I think they're all fetishists, Alex. I just don't believe it.
Well, alongside the fetishists, there are also the artists. There are those who are collecting old, defunct dildos, etc., to turn them into pieces of conversational artistry.
I can imagine having to have that conversation. Yeah, it's just a really powerful statement about feminism and sexuality. Like old dildos stacked up in a pile. You just stand there stroking a bit. Yes.
You are bang on. There's a woman called Jen Stein who you can see her stuff on Instagram at Adult Arts and Crafts 2, who basically just turns old dicks into miniature scenes to do with political activism. On a more light-hearted note, there's somebody who collects old dicks to turn them into like massive thrones, like a Game of Thrones.
Oh,
Game
wow.
of Thrones.
It's like something Neil Buchanan used to do on Art Attack.
If you are concerned about these issues with toy recycling, what you can do is make wiser, more ecologically sound choices about the toys you buy going forward. We've chatted about this a little bit in the past. There were things like the Earth Angel, which was a wind-up vibrator, a little bit like one of those wind-up torches, and stuff like the California Exotics Bullet that was solar-powered. And both of these things were innovative, but they didn't really look very sexy, and they didn't always have enough oomph to get people off. So
those might not work in a long, cold winter.
I think they did work, just not really with enough power and enough passion to please a lot of people's palates. The design of eco sex toys since then has come on a huge leap and bound. They're now a lot more sleek and slick. They're a lot more attractive. They're more high performance. And there's a lot more to choose from. The stuff like the Gaia Eco and the Fuck Green range, both of which are made from forms of plastic that are actually starch based. They're made out of cornstarch or sugarcane leftovers. So once you're done with doing them, you can just compost them along with your tea bags and your potato peelings and whatnot. They'll rot down, or at least their casings will. Womanizer, who we've spoken about before, who make their clit-sucking toys, they now do an eco version that's also made of one of these biodegradable plastics. There's a new company. I've actually brought some of their bobs with me.
Oh, good. Well, these don't look like organic materials. And I mean that positively, because I was thinking it's all very well saying you want something environmentally friendly, but you're putting it in a very sensitive place. And sometimes the idea of something that's, you know, completely natural might not be as appealing as something that's very smooth and plasticky.
The metal parts are actually made from recycled aluminium cans. So they were once a can of Coke, and now they're something to give you clang or a poke. The boxes that they come in are all made from brown card, so it's easy to recycle. The ink is made from soy, so it's low impact on the environment. Even the glue that's used in this packaging and in these toys is ecologically a-okay.
So I'm holding a peripheral, basically. So you screw it onto a base, do you?
Yeah, these are from a company called Love Not War. They're designed so that you buy one rechargeable base and then you can screw different tops into it.
That's good.
So they take fewer materials.
It's a bit like an Oral-B electric toothbrush, if you're trying to imagine. So you get the base that sits in the charger and then you can change the tops.
Yeah, and even if you don't choose an eco toy as such, selecting something that's well made, that's a design that you have confidence is going to bring you pleasure and suit your needs. So doing a little bit of homework and really thinking about what you're investing in rather than making an impulse buy means you're less likely to want to chuck that after you've fucked it in the future. You might even want to consider getting something custom made. So it's the sort of thing you want to cling on to and be passionate with forever rather than chucking it in the trash after it's been inside your gash.
Good. Although Fuck and Chuck, I think, is a good brand name for a disposable sex toy. Not that I'm saying such a thing should be used. I'm thinking the 1980s Fujifilm entrepreneur style, you know, device. The Fuck and Chuck. Just use it once, throw it away. Anyway, our thanks again to ExpressVPN for supporting the Foxhole. Alex, it says here that I should ask you now about a time where you've had to search for something that you wouldn't want others knowing about. I can't imagine what that is. Like, you tell us everything.
I have used VPNs or virtual private networks for multiple uses. For a start, they allow you to change your IP address. IP says essentially who you are and where you are digitally. When you're using a VPN, you can be wherever you want to be in the world, which is useful for me when I'm traveling. It allows me to watch TV shows in New York that I wouldn't usually have access to.
Yeah, but also around global content restrictions around sex. And we've talked about this before, haven't we? People getting chucked out of the UAE for bringing sex toys with them. For example, that's the sort of country if you're visiting where a VPN is very useful on.
Yeah, absolutely. I also use VPNs when I'm in hotels or anywhere where there's a firewall that blocks access to adult material, because otherwise I can't do my job. So VPNs help me work as well as, frankly, helping me wank.
When you use ExpressVPN, it is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers. You don't even notice it's there. It runs seamlessly in the background. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected. And Alex, how can listeners protect their online activity today and get a special deal?
If you head to expressvpn.com/man, you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1 year package.
That's expressvpn.com/man to learn more. And if you have a question of sex for Alex to answer on a future edition of The Foxhole, what do you need to do with it?
All you need to do is magic yourself over to modman.co.uk, that's with two N's, and hit feedback.
See you next month.
It's been a pleasure.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this episode of The Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new Manbassador. And it's Diane Parker from Poole, Dorset, mother to Manfan Dean Lacey, who says, "Hi Ollie, I'm a long-time listener who's just got round to buying you a beer. Cheers, Dean. Ever since I recommended the podcast to Mum, she loves to discuss each episode with me in great detail, normally before I've even listened to it. She laughs at the banter you and Ollie have, and loves the sex hole, by which she means foxhole. All in all, it's a strange conversation over dinner with Mum. I would love it if you could consider her an ambassador for Poole. I would, Dean. I have. Congratulations, Diane. If you'd like to be a Manbassador, buy us a beer, drop us a line, links on the website. Until next time, our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. And we'll see you with Stu and Tom and our annual How to Be a Dad special on August the 10th.
There must be something we stand to gain. Change.